This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we did. Started to burn too many things we found. That's the great Dar Williams singing the Solartopia song with the wonderful Pete Seeger and the brilliant David Burns, who wrote the lyrics for that that Grammy-winning song that was on the album Tomorrow's Children from Appleseed Records. This is Harvey Wasserman. A very special show today in the wake of the catastrophe of the selection of 2016. And now we're all living in dread of the coming disaster that we are going to have to figure out how to survive. I'm joined by two great guests, my usual co-conspirator, Bob Fetratis, talking to you from the frozen heartland of the dying Rust Belt in Central Ohio, and Jill Stein, the presidential candidate from the Green Party in 2016 and truly the only hero to emerge from that disastrous, stolen, rigged, and completely screwed election. Jill, are you with us?
I certainly am, and what an honor to be on this show with two of my heroes for election protection and election integrity and the new agenda for democracy that we need in order to fight back.
Well, thank you, Jill. Are you in Boston?
I am. I'm just outside of Boston, yes, in Lexington now.
Okay. So Bob is in Central Ohio, where I lived, and Jill, you are near Mount Auburn Hospital, where I was born, and I want to tell all you and all my listeners that, you know, I'm honored that you'll be celebrating my birthday this coming December 31st. raise a glass to me as you raise a glass to the end of this horrendous year. Bob Fetratis, you're there with us in Columbus?
I am, Harvey. Your hometown. I'm paying for past sins that I'm unaware of, but it's always great to be on the show with somebody of Jill's quality, and again, tremendous courage in doing what had to be done to expose essentially a broken democracy and a broken political system.
Yes, it's and catastrophically so, as we envision the horrific prospect of, I don't even want to talk about it, so, although we'll get to it. So, Jill, let's start. You ran a magnificent campaign, and I'm the only candidate with just unimpaired integrity in the whole process. And then you upped the ante by doing what any sane person in an election like this last one would have done, which is you went in and fought with Bob as your chief attorney for recounts in where they could have been done, where they could be done, or should have been done, and made a difference. Can you tell us about your motivations and what you hoped to accomplish by going in there and doing what Hillary Clinton, Gary Johnson, and everybody else in the world should have done by demanding recounts? Tell us what your agenda was, please.
Thank you. And, you know, I'll say that I was following in your footsteps, and especially the work that Bob Fetratis did and that David Cobb did as the presidential candidate in 2004, challenging in Ohio, attempting to challenge in New Mexico, and exposing these black boxes that in which all kinds of mischief can be done without our knowledge, without our awareness, without accountability or transparency or the light of day. And I had had the enlightening experience back in 2006 of running for Secretary of State here in Massachusetts. And at that time, I became very aware of what was going on in the fight for election integrity. And when, I would say back then, starting in 2006, from the moment I became aware of this just very dark, hidden dimension of our elections over which we the people have, virtually no control, I was convinced that if it ever came into my court to be able to challenge an election, to be able to call for a recount, to be able to shine daylight on this hidden, secret, dark corner of our elections, that if ever I had the chance to do that, well, of course I would do that. How could there be any question about, doing my part as a candidate to help expose this grave underbelly of our election system? So when I was asked throughout the campaign, throughout the 2016 campaign, would I challenge, would I call for a recount after the election, what I always said was that if there was a case to be made, if there was something that we could actually fight in court, that of course I would provide my campaign as the legal vehicle for that challenge and that call for a recount. So when I learned just before Thanksgiving that indeed there was a case to be made, that there were these red flags, these irregularities, these machine liabilities, particularly in three states that were begging for scrutiny and review, I didn't have to think about it, and I didn't have to talk to anybody. I felt if I said no when democracy came knocking, that I just couldn't live with myself, for the duration. This is just not something you can say no to. You have to, do your part and help democracy struggle against this corporate, privatized, money-controlled election system. And I am... I'm very happy. We asked the question, do we have a voting system we can trust, a voting system which is accurate, secure, and just, which makes every vote count and counts every vote, which is free from de facto Jim Crow in our elections? Do we have such a system? We asked that question, and we got a resounding no for an answer, and in doing that, we helped build this movement for election integrity, for election protection, for voting justice, whatever you want to call it. It's a movement, and it has everything to do with the technology of voting, how we vote, but it's also about our right to vote, our ability to vote without voter suppression, without being stripped from the voter rolls, without being intimidated against coming out to vote, and without being denied knowledge of who we can vote for. I see this as a several-pronged agenda here that includes many things, including voting technology, but it's also ranked choice voting so that we can vote without fear. It's also voting with empowerment, voting with the knowledge of who we can vote for, with open debates, that is, debates that are controlled by a People's Debate Commission, and getting rid of this scam of a debate system, this presidential commission, or this commission, this corporate commission on presidential debates. So all this comes together, and challenging, calling for the recount was, I felt like it was a really important historic moment for us to stand up and shine the daylight on that vote count, because this is the time to do it. This is when we had the public's attention, and this was when legally it was relevant.
Well, that's a great statement, Jill, and very moving to me. And I can't thank you enough for what you've done. Bob Petrakis, do you want to, as Jill's attorney in this procedure, do you want to tell us why you chose to proceed in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and what prompted this and what you hope to achieve.
Well, again, I wasn't on the litigation team. I was the party and Jill's recount campaign attorney. Since Jill was in on these meetings, I don't think it's any great secret. What we were looking for, as Jill has said, are red flags. You and I wrote an article about this, Harvey. We were using the U.S. State Department standard, also used by the Agency on International Development. I think it's best to treat the elections in the U.S. by international standards. And I say this as a former international election observer. I had the privilege of being one of the observers in the first ever election in El Salvador back in 1994, where I co-wrote the report and edited that report and delivered it to the UN. So my approach was this, look to the exit polls. Those are the red flags. If there's a great disparity between how people are saying that they just voted and the actual vote count, you cannot assume, and our government doesn't assume this, that that's a correct vote. The first thing you've got to do is to check the instruments. Following that, you got to make sure the machines are recording correctly. And that's a huge problem, as Jill ran into. That is the Stein recount campaign, right? If there's no paper in the machine to do simple recounts, and if courts and judges won't let you look at the source codes or look at the forensic computer evidence, how can we verify a system that's inherently unverifiable, where we have partisan, for-profit, partisan companies secretly not only counting our vote, but running the databases for voter registration, running the e-poll books, doing the central tabulation, doing the election night reporting, as well as programming all of the computer machines and the tabulators.
Yeah, so I want to make an overview statement. Bob, you've been been an election protection activist for many years, and Joe, you've been a stalwart in the Green Party. I want to say basically this. The 2016 election was stolen. It was stolen first by the disenfranchisement of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Black, Hispanic, Asian American, and Muslim, primarily, voters through the use of a program called CrossCheck, which was revealed by Greg Palast. And we went into this election with a very substantial percentage of the American electorate pre-Jim Crow disenfranchised. The election then proceeded, with or without Russian intervention, which is a minor issue as far as I'm concerned, if an issue at all, and people went in to vote across the United States, and in most cases were confronted either with touchscreen electronic voting machines, which are completely black box with no public recourse or monitoring available whatsoever, or on Scantron ballots, which could be manipulated again in their counting, and were given hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of provisional ballots, which generally went in the trash. And we emerged with a candidate who was clearly not the winner in any way, shape, or form, and we are now living in terror of what comes next. Is that a reasonable thumbnail summary, Joe Stein, of what happened in this election? And what would you add?
I would add that, this was an election in which over 80% of voters said that they were disgusted with the election. 75% of voters were screaming to open up the debates because the two major party candidates were the most disliked and untrusted in our history. And most people were voting against the candidate they hated the most rather than for a candidate that represented their values. And an election in which money played a bigger role than ever post to Citizens United and the other Supreme Court decisions that have taken place over the past many decades. This didn't just happen. This wasn't new. So let me just maybe add a kind of an overarching thought here, which is that this election sort of represented the meltdown of all safeguards for our democracy, in which our democracy was extremely hijacked, not only by the way in which we vote, but by the money that sponsors the process, by the corporate consolidated media that gave away billions in free media to the leading establishment candidates, you know, and in which voters were systematically denied the power of even knowing who they could vote for. Over 70% of voters did not know that they had the option of our campaign, for example. We were systematically whited out. So, you know, it was an election rigged far beyond what Donald Trump could possibly imagine. And the outcome of the election was, not surprisingly, every bit as toxic as the process of the election as well. And in many ways, this represents the failure of this corporate two-party system. And it leaves us, you know, at that sort of rock bottom place that sometimes you have to hit in order to turn life and civilization around. And I guess what I want to stress here is that there was this, you know, mythology throughout the election that, you know, that these candidates were our only choices. I think there's also a mythology right now that Donald Trump is so powerful that we have to cower in fear. And, you know, I would love to, you know, to address that. Maybe that requires a whole hour's show in and of itself, but I do want to be sure to just kind of challenge the prevailing mythology that's kind of being rammed down our throats again about what an unbeatable and powerful administration this is. This is a guy who comes to power with the lowest favorability ratings ever for an elected president, a guy for the first time who won, so-called, an election in which his opponent had a higher favorability rating than he did, and also a candidate, or I should say a president-elect, who is absolutely, what's the word, you know, encumbered, subsumed by a web of financial arrangements, business deals, corporations, and government relationships that are going to tie him in knots. This is a president who basically will not be able to move forward because he is so tied up in deals, partnerships, and entanglements that create a minefield of ethical, legal, and constitutional liabilities across the globe, not just conflicts of interest, but business developments will appear to benefit from insider knowledge, whether they actually do or not, you know, might be debatable, but they are all going to look like they are benefiting from insider trading, from the appearance of bribery when business deals are followed by favorable White House decisions and vice versa. He's going to be totally hobbled by corruption accusations, and I just want to remind you that within the last year or so alone, we've seen two presidents brought down by corruption scandals that look like they are small potatoes compared to how Mr. Trump is entering the presidency. And I'm referring to South Korea, where basically millions of people organized and got out in the street, and that president is now basically out facing charges of corruption and impeachment. And also in Guatemala, little old Guatemala, where hundreds of thousands of people organized, got out in the street, and brought down that president, who was actually arrested for his participation in a corruption kickback scandal. And the the encumbrances of those presidents really pale massively compared to the kinds of encumbrances that this president is walking into. And though he's got a really loud voice and, you know, and is a bully beyond compare, this is kind of an emperor without any clothes. And without clothes, this guy doesn't have a whole lot going for him. And the people he's appointing, you know, really, I think they're questionable legalities here, too, when you are appointing people whose avowed purpose is to destroy the cabinet divisions that they are being appointed to. So there's just a lot of really weird, toxic stuff going on here, and the American people don't like it and are not buying it in spite of the very polite discourse that's taking place on the corporate media.
Well, since Donald Trump doesn't have any clothes, as you say, I think I want to put in here, especially given his hair color, that he would look really good in orange. And I'll leave it at that. Bob, what do you want to add to Jill's brilliant statement here, please?
Oh, and I agree with her analysis. But and my thought is that we've got to start with the basics. Right, ensuring in our Constitution or federal legislation that everyone who's a citizen has a right to vote in this country. And again, if we, the European Union, for example, has it in their Constitution. And getting back to the original notions is also, we don't even know that the samples are correct. You've got one monopoly, Edison Research Group, that is out there working for a cartel, the election pool of the four major networks in the AP and CNN. So our entire system has been absolutely privatized to the point if we call the Carter Center and ask them, they'll say that, no, they don't monitor U.S. elections because we don't meet the minimum standards for democracy. And I couldn't agree with Jill more than we have to take on Trump as soon as possible. And one last thing I'd like to say is that I know there were questions floating around, and you know, I take responsibility to some extent for them. The format is we were looking for states out there where the exit polls unadjusted were in direct conflict with the official vote total. That is, they were suggesting somebody else won and that the standard deviation was at least three standard deviations away from what the people were saying versus the official count. So some people say, well, why didn't you recount some of these Clinton states? The one state where it looked like Hillary did better than expected really was New York, where she got an unexpected 6.2% pickup, Harvey. But, you know, we could have given her three times that or given all those votes back to Trump and doubled them, and he still wouldn't have won the states. That's why we weren't in places like Nevada or places like Maine. The exit polls indicated that Clinton had won there, or Ohio, right? Ohio had really funny numbers, 8.5% unexplained shift. But by one-tenth of a percent, it indicated that Trump was actually winning in Ohio. So what we were looking for was those states where the voters were saying something altogether different than the non-verifiable official results from the state in the black box voting apparatuses.
Well, Bob, you and I have been doing election protection work for at least since 2004. Every year we have a favorite. My favorite black whatever box situation this year was the 75,000 ballots turned in Michigan that didn't have a presidential preference, the presumption being that people were so disgusted by the whole process that they came out to vote, stood in line, voted for all the major offices, passed up the chance to vote for Jill or for Gary Johnson rather than Trump or Clinton, and left 75,000 presidential preferences unchecked in an election won or turned on 10,000 votes. Jill, you did finally, it's amazing, you know, the mainstream media, the corporate media, I consider us to be the mainstream media because I think we in the so-called left alternative media better reflect the views of the American public than the corporations at CNN, NBC, Fox, and the rest of them. But finally, after the election, the C-election, really, I don't call it an election, you did get some attention in the media. What was your message, and what's the most important thing you want to continue to tell people in the wake of this disaster? And you know, I want to say also, by the way, and this is extremely important, that you and Bob and the rest of the Green activists jumped into this recount with no money, no funds available, and you wound up with $7 million in small donations. I think that's astonishing. What do you think that says about what the American people really think about what's going on here?
There's no doubt the American people came out of this election even more disgusted than they were when they went into it. And people were pretty disgusted with the political system as it was. Democrats and Republicans are now both minority parties. The largest group of voters is independent, have basically divorced both of the political parties. The crisis of this election was very much a bipartisan crisis, and in many ways this is a turning point, a tipping point, a breaking point, if you will, with the political establishment that has delivered the likes of Donald Trump. And the craziness that we are fighting right now, you know, which is also the craziness of a corrupted election system, is bipartisan. And, you know, I feel very strongly, and this election has only confirmed that for me, that this is a political struggle. And as we struggle for election integrity, as we struggle against the particular craziness of Donald Trump, we are struggling for a new political vision. The Green Party is the one national actor which is not corrupted by predatory banks, fossil fuel giants, war profiteers. We are the only political party at the national level that does not take money from corporations, from lobbyists. We don't have a super PAC. As you were saying, Harvey, you know, the real media is the likes of what we are talking on right now. It is the media that's not corrupted by corporations. And the same is true for real politics. And I feel like my message out there, when we were able to break through, you know, the whiteout that took place before the election and after the election, when people were so agonizing and trying to soul search, but being systematically denied a new perspective. You know, we were shut out. The Greens were shut out of that supposedly, you know, post-election dialogue soul searching. We were very threatening because we do have, you know, we have a politics of integrity. We know what we're talking about here. And, you know, the effort was being made to shut us down after the election. And we were able to break through in this recount campaign. And we launched it 2 days before Thanksgiving. Actually, I believe it was Wednesday before Thanksgiving, so it was like the day before. Everybody was busy. Everybody was really depressed and, you know, had great incentive to just focus on their family feasting. But what happened? You know, it just spread like a wildfire, and we blew through our first goal, which was to fund Wisconsin to raise $2.5 million. We blew through that first goal in like 8 hours or less than that. So then we went on to the second goal to try to fund the second state. And basically in about a week, we had raised $7 million, more than that, enough to fund the three states. And what I found was that, you know, the media always seizes the opportunity to try to fight political opposition. And that was a lot of why they opened the door to me. They sort of felt obliged to, but then it was kind of, well, you're a spoiler, aren't you? Which gave me an opportunity to just tear that concept to shreds. Number one, that the math doesn't support that because most Greens would not have come out to vote. So it's not like we deprived Hillary of a victory anywhere. But the bigger issue is that the whole concept of spoiling is entirely wrong. Silencing political opposition is not how you strengthen a democracy on life support. You know, and anyone who would argue that silencing opposition candidates is how we solve the problem of the greater versus the lesser evil, not at all. You solve this by, you know, by changing your voting system. So you go to ranked choice voting and allow people to actually vote their values, not their fears, knowing if your first choice is eliminated, your vote is automatically reassigned to your second choice. So just being accused of being a spoiler gave me an opportunity to talk about how to really fix the election system in that regard, and opening up debates and to really blow open this whole discussion, as well as talking about the need to get rid of these black box machines, which are an invitation to machine and human error, corruption, malfeasance, and all the rest. Get rid of the black box voting machines. We need hand-marked paper ballots that are either counted by hand or that are put through the scanning counting machines, but those need to be audited systematically. We need to have automatic recounts whenever there are certain triggers that are met, whenever there are red flags. We need to have automatic recounts, and we should have publicly accountable programming of these machines and ownership of these machines. These should not be a private profit, controlled system. So it's a winning agenda. There's a lot of momentum behind it. Not only did we raise $7 million, but over 10,000 people came out to volunteer in three states overnight. And there are very strong movements now in each of those three states and in other places as well to really make these things happen. And in fact, on the 3rd of January, Rick Lass, who was one of our on-the-ground field coordinators, and myself will be in Wisconsin for the opening day of their legislative session, and there will be legislation filed to actually get rid of these machines that are an invitation to disaster and who were not by any means exonerated by these recounts, because where the recounts took place with machines, it was the same machines doing the same thing all over again, like asking the same doctor for a second opinion. That doesn't give you a second opinion. So we don't know what's going on in these machines, and the recount tells us nothing about that. It only tells us that this system is very resistant to transparency and accountability, which is why this is a political problem, a problem of the Republicans and a problem of Democrats. You could look to the primary, the Democratic primary, where there should have been many recounts on very suspicious campaign results, where Clinton trounced Sanders, where people were stricken from the voting rolls and where hundreds of thousands of votes were not counted. So this is a bipartisan problem. They both need to be held accountable, and we all benefit from it. It's not candidates, it's voters who benefit from having a voting system that we can trust, which is accurate, which is secure, which is publicly owned and scrutinized, and which is just and free from the trappings of modern-day Jim Crow. This is what we deserve. And it's very exciting that the momentum for this is only growing.
Well, Joe Stein, presidential candidate from the Green Party, I know you've got to go. We've been joined on the phone by Lori Grace, a great election activist, election protection activist. I do want you to do me one favor, Jill, if you would, in 35 seconds or less, or however long you want to give us. I want you to tell us, if you can, real quickly, the content. Summarize for us, will you please, the alternative vision in terms of actual policy that the Green Party put forward, because so much of that gets lost in the process. And I don't want to let you go without telling us the Green Party vision of the world that we could expect if there were a fair election and people could actually have voted their preference and their choice and their knowledge. What would you have brought as president to this country in terms of policy?
So what the Green Party stands for really is an America and a world that works for all of us, not just for the 1%, but works for everybody. And that is a world that puts people, planet, and peace over profit, And specifically, that means an emergency jobs program that solves the unemployment and the underemployment problem, that creates living wages and gives you a right to a job, and a job which is also part of a massive program to solve the climate emergency. So we solve the economic and the climate emergencies in one fell swoop, and we reach 100% clean renewable energy by 2030, which is in time. It's what the science tells us we have to do if we are going to solve the climate crisis and get out of here alive. That's sort of the basis of where we start, and that includes clean energy, a healthy and sustainable food system, and public transportation, as well as ecosystem restoration.
Well, that sounds great. Jill Stein, I suspect that busy signal is coming from Ohio. We've had that problem before. But, Jill, and of course we're talking about a solartopia here, a green-powered Earth. That's where the jobs are. I want to point out, by the way, something you can use as you travel. There are more than 200,000 people working in this country in the solar industry. It's roughly 210,000. Another 80 or 90,000 are working in the wind power industry. Those numbers dwarf the employment in coal and in nuclear power. And that's where we need to go. What's that?
Oh, my goodness.
Jill, are you still with us? Hello, Jill Stein? We'll be calling back in, I'm sure. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president 2016, went ahead and broke new ground by demanding recounts in three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Bob Patrick is my other guest today, along with Lori Grace, who was the chief attorney there. And we are – what's that? Okay, Jill, you're back with us. Thank you.
Sorry, I got cut off there. Just finishing up to your response to your very important question. So in addition to an emergency solution for the climate and economic crisis, we also call for health care as a human right. We call for bailing out the students like we bailed out the crooks on Wall Street. We need to put an end to student debt and make public higher education free. We need to create a welcoming path to citizenship for the immigrants who are at the heart and soul of our economies and always have been. We need to put an end to police violence, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, an end to these endless wars that are making us less secure, not more secure, and which are also bankrupting us. We call for a foreign policy based on international law and human rights and diplomacy, not on economic and military domination. And finally, solving the climate crisis, largely through the Green New Deal. And we have the power. We have the numbers. Just the number of people trapped in student debt alone is enough to win a three-way presidential race. It's all about getting the word out, and it's all about getting organized. And we have yet another incredible opportunity to do that now in the era of Donald Trump, who really represents the failure of this bipartisan, corporatized system of democracy, which is essentially, you know, an oxymoron. You can't have a corporatized democracy. So it's time for us to stand up and change it. And I want to encourage people to come out, if you can, to Occupy Inauguration on January 20th. There will be lots of local Occupy inaugurations as well for us to stand up and say that we do not consent. This is not our president. We're going to create a whole new way forward.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jill Stein. I think in the coming year, we're going to start looking and probably transcending from mass demonstrations, which I can envision some really big ones coming up into the world of strikes and boycotts. And that I'm sure you and the Green Party will be in the forefront of the march to Solartopia. Jill, thank you. It's always awesome to talk with you. I hope you'll come back and join us again on the Solartopia.
I look forward
Green
to
Power
it.
Wellness
Thanks
Show.
So much. Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bob, are you back with us? Bob Patrakis?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, and Lori Grace, you're with us as well.
Yes, I'm here too. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. And Lori, I want to thank you for joining us. I believe you're sitting in a car on the side of the road, which is the in this world it's the new radio studio is a car by the side of the road. We've just heard from Jill Stein, the fabulous candidate for president from the Green Party. We're with Bob Strakis, my co-conspirator on numerous books, and also her attorney in the recount, and now with Lori Grace, a longtime election protection activist. What we want to talk about in the rest of the show is how we can actually change this election system or selection system. There's no conceivable method on earth that would be fair and reasonable that would have given us a Donald Trump for president. This is the very fact of that sentence that he's the president select indicates that the entire system has broken down. Lori, you have been working for years on this issue with Bob and I and others. Tell us what you would really like to see in an election system in the United States of America.
Well, first of all, I want to say that what happened with the recount showed me that I thought we were going to have our true day, so to speak, as election integrity activists. And what I saw was the system, the establishment, whether Democratic or Republican, opposed this, opposed transparency to citizens, opposed supporting trust and developing trust among citizens in our election system, and just preserved a kind of status quo, which was also had been previously manipulated. So now I am focusing on how can we protect something before an election occurs, because so far I see true attempts to create a recount have failed within our system. So I have wanted, and by the way, I tried to download the thing you want candidates to endorse, but nothing came through on my computer, so you may want to talk about it. But I want to bring forward the idea of people, if they're running for a governor, a secretary of state, a attorney general, a president, vice president, governor, you know, these, especially these higher up positions, that they lobby for, commit to donating, to putting 10% to 15% of what they raise in their campaign to election protection, and demand a kind of election protection, because I don't think there's a way of really saving things after the election has happened at this point. So,
well, let's put this forward.
I'm just particularly concerned about it. Now, you can mention what you were endorsing, but I want to see an electorate demand election protection before they give money to candidates, and I'd like to see candidates demand it.
Okay, so with Bob on the line here, let me put forward what we have come forward with, the so-called Ohio plan for a system of fair elections that could actually be considered democratic with a small d in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with universal automatic voter registration. Any American citizen should face no barriers whatsoever to registering to vote. Now, we know from Greg Palast's work and others that the Republicans especially, but also the Democrats, as especially seen in the California primary this year, 2016, where all sorts of roadblocks will be put in front of people who might be suspected of voting for Bernie Sanders. So we want to see all people having all American citizens having easy access to register to vote, with forms available at schools, at supermarkets, at Bureau of Motor Vehicles places, things like that, and that the voter registration rolls be managed in a way that's transparent, so that anybody going on the internet or any other way can find out if in fact they're registered to vote and where in fact they need to go vote in terms of their precincts. Mm-hmm. We want a very, very widely available, of course, precincts, easy voting in the neighborhoods. We want a four-day national holiday for voting. This nonsense of voting on a Tuesday and having to leave work, that's not acceptable. It discriminates against working people. It makes it easy to shortchange precincts on availability of ballots and so on, therefore costing millions of people their votes, which is what happened this time. We want the precincts run by our students, our high school and college students, and our at $15 an hour minimum wage there. And finally, and universal hand-counted paper ballots, utterly transparent so people know how they're voting, make it easy and simple to vote. Now, we do have a situation, some situations, where you have multilingual. There, for example, in Los Angeles, where I'm talking to you now, there are at least 14 languages. Very difficult to provide hand paper ballots here, but Bob has worked on, and there are the Trachtenberg system and other systems with open source code where you can use a machine to produce a paper ballot that you can see and that is reliably cast in boxes that don't leave. So we want hand-counted paper ballots or the equivalent of hand-counted paper ballots on a universally transparent publicly available source code. And finally, we want automatic, meaningful recounts where there are no financial burdens or other burdens placed on the public, but all elections are automatically recounted in a transparent manner that's reliable. Beyond that, now that's the basic mechanics of voting. And then beyond that, of course, we want the abolition of the Electoral College, which is six times now the loser. And, of course, this year it's a loser with a capital L to become president. And we want the abolition of gerrymandering. We want a systematic national process for providing congressional districts and state House districts that are based on population and not manipulated by race, class, and so on. And, of course, ultimately, we want the Citizens United repealed and a ban on corporate money in the electoral process. So those are the basic structural reforms that we want in what we call the Ohio Plan to give us something resembling a democratic process, which we haven't had in this country for a long, long time.
Right.
That's it. Bob, do you want to have anything to add to my summary there of our Ohio Plan?
No, other than we've got to, in the gerrymandering as well, two states have already been challenged, and their rigged congressional districts have been declared illegal. And Ohio should be next because of the dense packing, where they pack as many blacks as they can into a congressional district in order to create more white Republican districts. The courts are now declaring those illegal. In Ohio, there should be a split between Democrats and Republicans, perhaps 8-8. Instead, there's 12 Republican congressmen and only 4 Democrats because of the dense packing of these urban black districts.
Right. So gerrymandering, which, by the way, the origin of the term gerrymandering came from a politician in Massachusetts just after the Constitution, who set up congressional districts that the local newspapers said looked like salamanders. His name was Eldridge Gerry, so that's where we come up with gerrymandering. Lori Grace, what do you want to say about all this?
I think it's a really good plan. What I'd want to do, though, is I'd like to see it broken down into some achievable steps, step by step, what to do, and I see some of them are much more broad and more difficult to manage. And where I would like to be involved is in educating ordinary citizens on how to take steps to at least accomplish two or three of these or something, you know. And I think it's a wonderful plan.
Well, thank you for that.
It's more of the go-to. First you do this, then you do that, then, you know, it's just going to have to happen that way. But I think that there's enough profound disillusionment now that we might be able to gather the number of people on the momentum we need, possibly, to affect it. And I would target people's hopes and concerns around 2018, and I would also say that if we don't act now, 2018 may be manipulated as well.
Well, I think there's a pretty reasonable certainty that that will happen. I want to point out, by the way, that under the current system, we had the disaster of George W. Bush in 2000, where
right.
His selection was primarily perpetrated by his brother. The governor of Florida eliminated more than 90,000 primarily black and Hispanic voters. And then during the election, as pointed out by, and that was reported by Greg Palast, and during the election, we had electronic voting machines manipulated throughout the state, but especially in Volusia County in the midst of the 2000 election, where 16 were taken from Gore. That switched the whole momentum. In 2004, as Bob and I reported from Central Ohio, there were a good 100 that they stole it, but primarily eliminating three voters before the election, and then flipping the electronic vote count, as was done in Florida 2000. This year, as we saw, using the cross-check software, about 30 Republican secretaries of state eliminated hundreds of thousands of black voters. And then, as Bob and Jill Stein found out in Michigan and primarily and also in Pennsylvania, they flipped the electronic vote count. And, of course, in Michigan, we also had 75,000 ballots that were cast allegedly without a presidential preference. Astounding. Bob, you were on the ground in Michigan and Wisconsin. What do you want to tell us about what went on there during those so-called recounts?
Well, first of all, it only went on for a few days in the southeastern part, and there was no law from 1954 that said if there were more ballots than people signed in, you couldn't count a precinct, or if the security seals on the ballot bags had been broken, you couldn't recount. So in Detroit, 59% of the precincts could not have been recounted, either because the seals were broken or there was one more ballot than people signed in. Now, at the same time, there were reports that there was one more ballot because that was the test ballot. So the Secretary of State there, who happens to be a Democrat, has pledged to actually attempt to audit the vote there. So Michigan had no real recount, and that, again, was an area where 10,000 or so votes had separated Clinton and Trump. So, I mean, that was just a great, great tragedy that our system as designed is incapable of being recounted. And, of course, the real joke was Pennsylvania, where not only did they interpret the law to say you had to have three people from 9,000 precincts, 27,000 people petitioning for a recount, but 70% of the machines didn't even have paper. These computer voting machines have paper in them in order to recount. Just absurd when you violate people's rights. Because your right to vote, Harvey, has to include a right to an accurate vote and a recount.
And in Pennsylvania, weirdly enough, actually has a Democratic governor. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah, but the in this case, the system itself, and really with the local judges who denied access, forensic computer experts to the machine, meant that essentially it wasn't going to happen. Remember, there's 50 different state systems, and most of them are uniquely bad.
Lori Grace, did you want to jump in with something on there?
Well, I just want to really echo what Bob has said, and you know, bring forward the way that we screw around with people's ability to see what really happened in elections. I mean, the laws do. And the system has designed things to support the status quo, and I'm really glad you mentioned the interstate cross-check as well. And one thing I'd like to bring forward that I thought was, you know, reasonably worthwhile, that, you know, our Threshold Foundation supported, was a long time ago in George Soros. It initiated a Secretary of State's project to have Secretaries of State that were really committed to honesty of elections. And we successfully elected Deborah Bowen and Mark Ritchie.
Okay. And very good. Lori, thank you. Lori Grace, thank you so much for that. We'll have to have you back on. Bob Patrakis, Joe Stain, signed. This show has been posted now. And we'll be back again next week to talk more about this. Thank you so much.